KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from the Excelsior.
West Portal.
Potrero Hill.
I'm from the Bayview.
Diamond Heights.
Inner Sunset.
Glen Park.
I'm a proud member of the Mission.
Coming up, the story behind the hardest street to cross in all of Oakland.
Crossing International is like playing double dutch. You're constantly peeking your head out to wait for your turn.
Then, an anthology by writers and artists of color celebrates diversity and addresses gentrification in San Francisco.
Because of gentrification, people of color were the endangered species, and that we survived because of our enduring values. Spiritual values, our connection with history, with the land, with each other.
That's all coming up on Cross Currents. A few years ago, Shanisa Williams moved to East Oakland near International Boulevard. And right away, she noticed something. The street didn't have a lot of traffic lights. Drivers rushed by without looking for pedestrians. She told her kids to be careful crossing the street.
The saddest part about it was, when I first moved over here and noticed, I said they're not going to do anything about it until somebody's kid get hit. But then my kid got hit and they still didn't do nothing about it.
One afternoon, Williams' son Jeremiah, who was 19, was crossing International when he was hit by a car. He's walking again, but the pain is still with him. And Williams is left wanting to know why more isn't being done to protect pedestrians. She wrote into KALW's community journalism project, Hey Area, with this question.
Why aren't there enough traffic lights on International?
KALW's transportation reporter Eli Wirtschafter went to get some answers.
Shanisa Williams takes me out to the intersection where her son was hit, 77th and International.
Go ahead, cross. Try. Good luck. It's really hard.
Williams is a short, powerful woman. She's got on a black t-shirt that says, "Act like a lady, think like a boss."
Crossing International is like playing double dutch. You're constantly peeking your head out to wait for your turn. And then when you get out there, you gotta be quick and get across, because you just never know what's coming.
There's no traffic light here, no stop sign, only a faded white crosswalk.
This crosswalk is, it looks horrible. It actually looks like kindergarten school paper with those lines in between it and the big writing. There's not a solid lines, and it looks like it hasn't been painted in years.
In July 2016, Williams' son Jeremiah was on his way home after playing football with his friends. Williams says he always looks both ways. She says even her chihuahua looks both ways before crossing International.
He was coming, he got to the middle, crossing International, and bam, he gets hit by a car. The car kind of pushes him up a few feet, looks, and keeps going. And I know that if there were more traffic lights, there would be a lot less pedestrians getting hit.
Williams has younger kids, too. They're 16, 11, and 10. She doesn't let the youngest ones cross the street on their own. She feels like the city is saying that their lives don't really matter.
Yeah, it's like, we don't care about your life. We don't have any regards for your safety. We're not concerned about your future because we're not even worrying about your present.
Williams was upset that there were no traffic signals between 73rd and 82nd, 11 whole blocks without a light or a stop sign. So she wrote into KALW to ask why. But she felt that she already knew the real answer, that poor neighborhoods, places with lots of people of color, never get what they need.
I mean, you want my serious answer? This the bottoms. This is East Oakland. They don't care. The people that got the power to do something, they don't care enough because it's not affecting them. They don't even care to clean up. So they definitely don't care about the people that's here.
The city of Oakland has known for a long time that International is dangerous for pedestrians. A city study in 2002 found that more people were hit here than any other street in Oakland. That's both total and in crashes per mile.
When we look at the pedestrian high injury corridors or where the crashes are concentrated, we see that International tops that list.
Nicole Ferrara is the head of Oakland's new Vision Zero program. That means it's her job to try to eliminate traffic deaths in Oakland. So I asked her the question that Williams asked KALW. Why doesn't International have more stoplights? And she said, to begin with, adding a signal anywhere costs more than you might think.
Upwards of about $465,000. per signal from, you know, planning to construction. So people ask, why can't we install a traffic signal tomorrow? It takes a lot of work and coordination.
The city only adds a few traffic signals each year, and International is an especially hard place to do it. It's a state route, which means Caltrans has to sign off on any changes. The street also has a lot of offset intersections, places where the cross streets sort of zigzag through.
It's confusing, it's hard to get through, it's hard to see the crosswalk all the time.
And it can be more complicated to design a signal. But putting aside the physical quirks of this street, Ferrara says what Shanisa suspects is basically right, that the poorest neighborhoods are the most dangerous for people crossing the street. She pulls out a couple of maps.
What I'm looking at here is a map of all of Oakland.
This first map shows which streets have the most crashes.
It's really illuminating how well this maps with another map that we have here, which is our historic redlined areas.
The second map shows neighborhoods that were redlined going back to the 1930s, the mostly black communities that the federal government said were too risky for banks to offer mortgages.
These historic decisions are still reflected in our street patterns today.
And they're reflected in traffic deaths, too. The city of Oakland found that Asian, Black, and Latino people are killed in crashes at more than twice the rate of white people. Nate Miley is an Alameda County supervisor who's made pedestrian safety one of his main issues. He was on the Oakland City Council back in the 90s. And he says at that time, International, which was then called East 14th Street, was even more unsafe.
My memories, particularly in the 80s and 90s, was that it was a street that was challenging for pedestrians to cross.
The city has a formula for where to prioritize adding new traffic lights, but Miley says it hasn't always lined up with where they're most needed. The only way to get around the formula is for the community to complain.
To say we want something here, regardless of your standard, of your formula.
The squeaky wheel gets the grease. So historically, the process has favored wealthier, more organized neighborhoods. But that could be changing. Last year, the city modified their formula for where to add pedestrian improvements. And now, low-income areas and neighborhoods with more seniors, disabled people, and people of color are supposed to get higher priority.
So the higher the disadvantage, the more likely this community is to get resources. They don't have to complain to get them.
Now, it just so happens that Shanisa Williams asked her question at a good time, because International Boulevard is on the brink of a transformation. AC Transit is building a new rapid bus line along the route, and in the process, the street is getting a complete makeover. The agency plans to add new traffic signals at 29 intersections along International. And on the very day that I interviewed Williams, we ran into a bunch of guys in safety vests and hard hats at the corner of International and 81st.
Let me ask, are you guys putting up street lights? Traffic signals?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Finally. Just look at that. Somebody must have heard me.
The foreman says the whole intersection is being redone.
New pavement, new paint, traffic signal, left turn. Good.
Wow.
So look at that. Look at that. I swear I feel like I've been asking the questions so much that I might have had something to do with it. Because I know every time I cross the street, I'm yelling about traffic lights for about 5 years. I'm telling you. I feel good. That is good. I'm gonna hold them to it, cause I drive across the street every day. So in a couple of weeks, I better see a pole or something, or I'm calling somebody.
A few weeks later, I went back to check, and it's true. Now there's a traffic signal there, and another one is planned for the exact intersection where Jeremiah was hit. Nicole Ferrara says the changes on International will make the street a lot safer. But the city still has a ways to go before it reaches its goal of zero traffic deaths.
We have about 30 people who are killed on our streets every year, and about every other day we have a severe or fatal crash. So we've got our work cut out.
The 29 new signals on International should be up and running by the end of next year. In East Oakland, I'm Eli Wirtschafter for Cross Currents.
That story came from a listener suggestion to our Hey Area project, where you ask the questions and we find the answers. You can vote on which question we should investigate right now at KALW.org. Look for the box that says Hey Area. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Gentrification continues to be on a lot of people's minds as the city of San Francisco goes through a shift in racial demographics. But census data show people of color make up over half of the city's population. A group of local artists and writers of color want to remind people about the city's diversity. They're part of the anthology Endangered Species, Enduring Values. The collection features works by over 70 contributors and illustrates the diverse experiences and cultural richness of the city. Shizue Siegel is the editor of Endangered Species, Enduring Values. She's been part of San Francisco's literary scene for decades. KELW's Janae Darden speaks with Shizue, or Shiz, about the book.
What does the title mean to you, and why did you create this book?
Well, initially, I had been thinking, because of gentrification, people of color were the endangered species, and that we survive because of our enduring values, spiritual values, our connection with history, with the land, with each other. But after a while, especially after the last national election, I realized that we are all, human beings are endangered all over the planet. And that there was something about people of color that was of value because we have had to survive on less for a long time. So I asked people in the call for submissions for this book.
Which was going to be my next question.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, that's fine. That's fine. I was going to ask you, what were you looking for when you sent out the call for submissions?
You know, I really wasn't sure what to expect, but I do know that I'm interested in the voices of real people, not just trained writers.
And many of the writers in your book came together last month at the main branch of the San Francisco Public Library to present their work, and I was there. Tony Robles is one of the people who made the cut of those more than 70 contributors that you have in the book. And he's a fourth-generation San Franciscan, and he wrote about the flavor of San Francisco in his piece, Soul Medicine.
Barbecue and cornbread and greens made by black hands. Adobo and rice eaten with thick brown fingers. A handwritten love note with a number 2 pencil. A street sax blowing colors across the sky. Tortillas and rice and beans and abuelita's voices rising through rooftops. Murals on our skin, wet with our stories, our lives, our revolution.
Well, the piece was inspired by the black out-migration and the tragedy, which is that, because so much of the black community, you know, facilitated people of color knowing who they were or even to become curious about who they were. So in a lot of ways, the black community in San Francisco was the roux, right, the base, right? The music, and we all felt that, you know. So that's something that's missing in San Francisco right now. You know, my uncle was a very highly regarded poet, you know, and one of his...
Who was your uncle?
My uncle, Al Robles. He was a Manila Town poet of the I Hotel. He grew up in the Western Addition, and one of the lines of his poems was, sometimes my heart is black, and sometimes my heart is brown, and sometimes my heart is black and brown at the same time. Sometimes my heart is Chinese, and sometimes my heart is Japanese. Sometimes my heart is Chinese and Japanese at the same time. Sometimes my belly is Chinese, and sometimes my belly is Latino, and sometimes my belly is Chinese and Latino at the same time.
Tony is real. And Tony, he owns the blend of all of the things that have made him and continue to impact him every day. He celebrates it all.
So let's hear from one writer who recently made the Bay Area home.
Hi, everyone. My name is Kelechi Ubozo, and I am a trauma survivor and a mental health advocate, and really excited to be part of this collection and see all you beautiful brown faces. This piece is called Lost and Found. When you arrive in San Francisco, a rebirth happens. Not that you are becoming someone new. Sometimes you're becoming who you were always meant to be. Maybe you're the Black poet going through a never-ending goth phase like me. Or you could just be a Black artist stifled by her strict parents' idea of success, like my mother. Mama arrived in San Francisco 37 years ahead of me. Growing up in an all-white neighborhood in Long Island, New York, was painful. For her older siblings, being part of the only Black family in the area was glorious. They were invited to the best parties. Everyone wanted to watch them dance, touch their thick afros, and be their best friend. None of this was extended to my shy, frumpy, lackluster mama. She was a hidden gem that no one was looking for. When I asked her why she traveled across the country to a place she'd never seen outside of magazines, she'd sigh and wistfully gaze toward the closest windows. It's a place where the lost go to find themselves.
That's Kelechi Ubozo, and there's a line in her piece after she talks about following her mother's footsteps to find herself in the Bay Area. And she says, Mama was right. Location is everything. Acceptance is expensive, and the city is fluid. I asked Kelechi about what that line means for her personally.
Yeah, you know, actually when the election happened, I considered moving back to Atlanta because I can afford it. And then when Trump was elected, I was like, well, I know what I'm paying for. And for me, it is really expensive and I don't enjoy that. But I'm also paying for a level of like wokeness that is not going to be back in my red state.
Okay, Shiz, to this day, even with the high cost of housing, San Francisco is still a city for people who want to belong.
It's a beautiful city. And it's a city that is 58% people of color. And we don't often think about it that way because we're so socialized to look at bus drivers and busboys and people like that as part of the furniture. But it's everywhere. It's like people of color are a part of what makes the city a magical place. Okay, this is an excerpt from a poem about my grandmother. It's called Bachan Grandma. In 1942, Pearl Harbor forced you from the coast into a tar paper desert, a shimmering mirage that would not dissolve. Inside your shoe, remnants of your previous life. A clipping Jap house burns to the ground. And cash from the realtor who paid next to nothing for your businesses. How many dollars remained when they let you out in 1946? Don't come back to the coast, friends warned. They're shooting out our windows at night. They won't sell us gas or fertilizer. So you came north to start again, at 57, on your knees, sharecropping strawberries in another tar paper compound.
Mm-hmm. And so what was going on during that era? Was that...
That was after Pearl Harbor, Japanese Americans were incarcerated. All the Japanese Americans on the West Coast were ordered to leave, and because neighboring states wouldn't take them, most of them were incarcerated, 120,000 people, men, women, and children. Two-thirds of them were American-born citizens. The other third were immigrants that had been in this country a minimum of 18 years, many of them much longer than that, but they, because of the color of their skin, they had not been allowed to be citizens.
And we're still seeing all of these things happening today, this idea of certain groups as being foreign threats. We're seeing that with people of Middle Eastern descent. And I spoke with one of the writers about the issue of identity that came up in the book. Her name is Dina Rod. She's Iranian-American. She was born in Oakland, grew up in Berkeley and Pleasant Hill.
It's something that I have had to grapple with my entire life, and I've never seen it as a threat until now. Only after the Muslim travel ban in January 2017, that's when I felt like an endangered species, and that's when I felt like I needed to say something about it, and that's why my piece, Fernway, is submitted to the anthology about that particular experience for myself.
I'm walking to the bookstore, Bird and Beckett. There's a literary magazine launch party being held there, and one of my poems has been selected for publication. At last, I'm a contributing writer. Published and stepping over pigeons sipping gutter water like cocktails, I am arriving, stepping over the threshold of something wondrous and new. I have a spring in my step. There's a man waiting at a bus stop, an unlit cigarette between his fingers. His hand reaches out for me as I pass by. He asks me if I'm American. I immediately tense up, my defenses engage, and I want nothing to do with him. My mind leaps to the worst possible conclusions, my body remembering strangers stopping me on the walks home from school, asking me if I spoke English, asking me where I was from, as the answer up the street wasn't good enough for their curiosity. Armoring my body against this man, who could quite possibly be a tourist, perhaps just asking for directions, or maybe even a lighter for his cigarette. But my tolerance for microaggressions has reached less than 10% in 2017. My steps quicken, my breath shortens as he reaches for me and I yell, "Leave me alone!" I rush past as he exclaims, "Wait, wait!" Can hear his footsteps behind me, my pulse races. Who do I trust in this landscape?
That's Dina Rod reading from her piece, Fernway, at the San Francisco Public Library. What kind of conversations have you had with the contributors of the book about the hope and fear for the city?
I think a lot of people are hopeful, and there are many of us. And it's not a division between people of color and white folks, because this town has so many progressive white allies. And, you know, it's not about anybody being better than anybody. It's about us all working together for a better life for all of us.
I spoke with the woman in the audience. Her name is Loba Yates, and she came to the event from Vallejo with her 10-year-old daughter. And Loba grew up in San Francisco, but she moved away.
Well, all of them were great, but Tiny's really stood out to me because, like she said, she was speaking on a population that people, they don't want to look at. We want to look the other way and act like they don't exist.
I am a poverty scholar, that houseless mama, that houseless daughter. I am a poverty scholar. All the people you don't want to see, never want to be, look away from me. What you gonna do, arrest me? We're in your city.
So it was just really nice hearing, you know, from someone like, hey, we are here, you know, I am human, you know, the things I'm going through does matter. And also seeing the artwork, that was another piece too, you know, the artwork was just so amazing. But one thing that stood out to me was Mark Harris, I believe that was his name, Home Sweet Home, the painting he did of the, you know, the white family sitting there at their house and, you know, just looking all content and, you know, but underneath their homes were, you know, our people. You know, all of that was built up on the backs of our people. So with that, I just know that there is greater strength inside of me to live to be my best self as these artists are doing. And yeah, try to make it better, you know, because we've had enough suffering, enough pain, enough, like, come on now, like, we deserve to be happy in our lifetime. That's when I want to see it. I don't want to have the hope for it, oh, yeah, you know, my grandchildren, when I'm gone. No, right now. Why not right now?
So, Shiz, how does what Loba said resonate with you?
That's exactly why I do what I do. I had never met Loba, but to hear her response, the fact that she came and that what she heard gives her hope.